Yes, there's something fascinating and, dare I say, almost mysterious about the bond between humans and the horse. I certainly saw it as a child in WA. My father bred racehorses, and there was something intangible between him and his horses. They weren't pets, like dogs. They had a prestige, a power, all their own, and he respected that. This cooperation of horse and us humans is the terrain Susanna Forrest covers in her new book, The Age of the Horse. It's not a dry history of the horse, more a ramble through times when human and horse interaction has been extraordinary. From the Nazi quest to save and breed a now extinct species of wild horse, the tarpan, to the high-status riding schools of modern China, and to the inspirational horse therapy programs for American war veterans, it's all here to make a very readable account of our relationship with Equus caballus. Susanna Forrest, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very glad to join you.
What is your connection to horses? It's much more than an academic interest, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a classic case. My mother had horses when she was young, and when I was born, they put me on a horse. Although I didn't have one growing up, it was sort of too late after that. So I was what the British horse magazine Horse and Pony used to call pony mad, but pony less.
Yes, you were pony less. You stayed pony less, didn't you?
A lot of reading about horses and a lot of imaginary horses and a lot of very long-suffering riding school ponies.
Well, look, your book is very extensive. You start with the dying days of wildness, when humans outcompeted the horse for resources and hunted wild horses until very few of them remain. There are two that you focus on, the tarpan and the taki, or the Przewalski horse. Could you tell us a little about the tarpan, please?
The tarpan, some people aren't totally sure if it was a genuinely wild horse. We know the Przewalski or the taki was, because we still have them today, and they have a different number of chromosomes to domestic horses. But the tarpan, it was at the eastern end of the steppe, and it was also, until the 18th century, it was in forests in Eastern Europe. And that's when it kind of died out there.
And so, they ranged really, you say, right through northern Germany, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, Western Russia.
Yeah, I mean, they are possibly the wild horses mentioned by Herodotus down near the Black Sea, and they are probably the horses that were in this huge primeval Polish forest up until the 18th century.
And I've never heard about this before, but you let me know that the Nazis wanted to breed the tarpan. In the summer of 1942, you write, the dirt roads were dry but passable, and German troops, guns and horses flowed east and south, heading across the grasslands north of the Black Sea towards the Don River and onwards to Stalingrad. Nearly 750,000 horses had been removed to the Eastern Front to haul the artillery of Operation Barbarossa. But two went the other way. Tell us about those two, please. What did the Nazis want with them?
Well, it's odd. I mean, the Second World War, the German army used a huge number of horses, more than they used in the First World War. But they also spent a lot of time on these sort of prestige breeding programs. Like, they were very interested in Lipizzaners, which were no use to the war effort, and these wild horses, because they were trying to recreate all kinds of extinct wildlife that they thought belonged to this mythical German pure past. So they were also trying to make aurochs, wild cows. And they thought that if they bred wild animals to the right combination of domestic horses that looked like wild animals, they would somehow magically turn up, you know, this extinct creature. So they knew that there were two of these Przewalski horses. They're actually gathering them from zoos across the lands that they conquered. And there were several in the Ukraine on this massive estate, which is still there and still has the horses on it.
And there were two German brothers, weren't there? Lutz and Heinz Heck. And Goering was their patron.
Yeah, one of them ran Munich Zoo and the other ran Berlin Zoo. This was their sort of program. And it's been a sort of slightly dodgy territory to discuss ever since, because they both carried on in their jobs after the war. And people are not sure, you know, what level of cooperation happened, if they were maybe excused and shouldn't have been. But they did manage to create this fake tarpan, which is called a heck horse, and those are still around. Some people still have them on wildlife farms and grazing programs.
Extraordinary story. What a nutty it all was. And then before we move on, I think Taronga Zoo in Sydney is involved in helping breed up numbers of this sole surviving wild horse, Shavasky horse.
Shavasky or Taki, yeah.
And you went to Mongolia to try to see this horse, Susanna.
Yeah, I was very lucky because they went extinct in the wild in the 1960s. So that was actually the last of genuinely wild horses. And the ones that survived were in zoos in Europe, in Australia, in America. And they were gradually sort of bred, which was difficult because they were very inbred. They're all descended from 13 horses at the end of the Second World War. And in the 90s, they had gradually got them back to a stage, and they'd been keeping them in what they call semi-reserves, which were sort of near wild conditions. And then they began to take them back to Mongolia, to two sites, but to this one that I went to in particular called Hustai, which is in the steppe. It's not that far outside Ulaanbaatar. And it's basically the most incredible area of grassland covered in wildflowers, very, very diverse. And it's there because of the horses. Grazing land around it for local shepherds is pretty dry and pretty used up, but because of the horses, this sort of pocket has been preserved. And they've got, I think, 200 or 300 of them there now, and they've been breeding and holding their own and surviving the winters very nicely. It was extraordinary to go and see them there.
I can imagine. One of my favourite sections of the book is where you describe life in London under Queen Victoria. You create such a vivid picture of the jobs that horses did and the variety of horses. Just how fundamental were they to life in the city?
I kind of had a mental image of the Industrial Revolution as a sort of series of cogs, and, you know, manpower is obviously one cog, steam is another cog, and horses is the sort of interconnecting one. You know, you might have trains, but you still needed horses to get the goods and the people to and from the trains. You needed them to get stuff out of mines. You needed them to operate trams, transport goods around, to do farming, to turn small engines and machinery. I mean, there was, other than manpower, there was no other way to get things over the shorter distances. So they just needed this ever-increasing number of horses, which didn't peak, I think, until the 20th century.
And when I presume the car's arrival dramatically reduced their need.
Yeah, it's a combination of cars and electricity. So electric trams come in, I think, in the 1890s, and then cars. But it was still, you know, even in the 1930s, some businesses went back to using horses, having converted to vans, because at that time it could still be cheaper. So, you know, we're very used to seeing pictures of horses, or, you know, you watch a period drama on the television and it's all clip, clop, clip, clop. But I don't think you realise how important they were.
Let me just tell listeners that I'm speaking with Susanna Forrest, who is horse mad, but she's written a very interesting book that anyone with curiosity about history itself and horses would like. It's called The Age of the Horse. What became of the bigger breeds of horse? Because you're quite interested, aren't you, in how the various breeds evolve?
Yeah, I think we think of the Shire horses and the Clydesdales. There's been a long-standing story that's not quite true, which is that they originally, you know, war horses that medieval knights rode. And that's not actually the case. They're a product, really, of the agricultural revolution itself, because that was when breeding methods changed and there was food to build horses like that, as it were. So they're sort of part and parcel of this burst of increased productivity and sort of better living standards. And now pretty much all of those breeds, because they're not used for work in the UK, they're either endangered or sort of rare, or heading towards sort of being obsolete.
Yeah, but you found them thriving in rural America.
Yeah, this is partly, I mean, largely because of the Amish. There's going to be predicted to be 1 million Amish in America by, I think, 2050. There's a lot of them now. And of course, they are extremely reliant on horsepower, and they've kept breeding them. They've also kept developing the equipment. So there's now also new generations of non-Amish farmers who are using horses to farm, because they're basically an ecological zero sum, you know.
Yes.
The horses, they harvest their own fuel, then they provide fertilizer for more fuel. And so that it's close to zero carbon as you can get.
And it was in rural America that you glimpsed, I suppose, that special affection, beautifully observed by you, that humans have for horses. And in a way, that's what I think I saw a little bit of with my father. Can you try to recreate that for us?
I think we have this funny thing where, you know, horses are mammals, we're mammals. We have a lot of our biology in common, and therefore we pick up signals from each other very easily. I think we're probably a little bit at cross purposes because we have all these sort of motivations like work and status and whatever that horses don't really have. But there are times when, as it were, what works for horses and what horses find makes them happy or relaxed coincides with, you know, what we want from them. And I think it's this funny, very immediate and instinctive and sort of two mammals relationship, and one where we have this sort of other appreciation of them.
Well,
and we can work with them.
It is hard to put words to. I mean, for instance, I was going to come to this towards the end, but you do pay a visit to veterans programs in America, and there are all versions of this everywhere, certainly are in Australia, with troubled children too,
yeah,
that are aimed at calming former soldiers. Tell us about what you saw, because it is akin to a small miracle, I think, these stories.
I mean, one of the experiments that somebody did was to put horses with people who are blindfold, and they put them firstly with people who are confident with horses, but they'd made them run around a lot, so they had a raised heart rate, and then with people who were nervous with horses. And when the horses were with people who were confident, their heart rates went up, you know, they kind of perked up. When they were with the people who were nervous or stressed, the horses seemed to just calm down and slow down, like they were almost trying to sort of bring the person sort of to their level. So, I mean, the horses they're using generally in these programs with the veterans are pretty philosophical horses.
But these are veterans who've got traumatic brain injury and PTSD,
yeah,
and are really often troubled and highly agitated people, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think the horses are, because they're so reactive and because they're nothing to do with humans. I mean, people who've worked with kids with authority problems have told me this, that the horses are kind of neutral source. You know, it's not a grown-up or a drill sergeant or whatever telling you to do something. It's that you need to respond to the horse. You need to work around the horse. And I think that is a factor of it. It's also that there is this military history with horses. You know, there is a degree of prestige. And working with big animals, several of them said this to me, you know, when they've lost, you know, the ability to brush their teeth or to sort of follow some simple commands, it was good to be able to control to some extent, you know, this big animal. That was definitely a factor in it for them.
Yes. Look, I had to stop reading parts of it about what had happened to the horses, particularly the horses. For instance, 20,000 horses died at Waterloo in 1815, 10,000 at the Battle of Caravaggio in 1448, 7,000 in a single day at Verdun in 1916. But you tell this amazing story, which I'd like to finish on. Perhaps the strangest and most poignant story is that of the Household Cavalry horses, which fought at Waterloo and was subsequently cashiered out of service at auction. The King's surgeon, Sir Ashley Cooper, bought 12 of the worst wounded, took them to his home in Hemel Hempstead. With the help of his servants, he began to painstakingly remove bullets and grape shot from their hides and muscles. Eventually, they recovered enough to be turned loose to graze in the park. And this is the amazing thing. One morning, looking out across his land, the surgeon saw the 12 horses form a line, shoulder to shoulder, then, without a cue, charge forward at a gallop. After a few strides, they spun and retreated as formally as in a drill, and then broke from their line and careered about freely in high spirits. And they did this again and again and again. Mm. I just thought that was the most extraordinary story.
I think it's a perfect example of stuff that horses like to do coinciding with what people have trained them to do. Because, I mean, I just literally came across a description of Mustangs, someone seeing them in the wild in America in 1841. And he says, you know, this line of horses appear on the hill and sort of look at the humans. And then he says they turn, and they turn as if they're in a cavalry drill. That's the exact word he uses, you know, that when horses are together as a herd for protection, they have to watch each other all the time, which is why they're good at watching us. And then they have to act so quickly together that it's almost like synchrony. And I think basically the cavalry drill that these horses were taught just tapped into that instinct. You know, I'm guessing they got quite a kick from doing it, which is why they were still doing it even when they weren't at war.
Well, Susanna Forrest, there's just so many more anecdotes and stories that really make you gasp in your book. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Geraldine.
Susanna Forrest's book is The Age of the Horse. It's published in Australia by Allen and Unwin. Would very much welcome your thoughts on that particular take on history.